Well, now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, all the way from the beautiful town of Bakersfield, California. Sober since October 25th of 06. That would be many years, many days, and many hours. Her favorite quote is, "Nothing happens in God's world by mistake." And one of the principles she practices here is staying connected. So if we could give Erica W. from Bakersfield a big, warm Valley Group welcome. Come here and share her story.
Thanks. Hey, everybody. My name is Erica, and I am an alcoholic. And, I'm really excited to be here. Really grateful to you. Thank you. No pressure. So I guess I will start at the beginning. Seems like a pretty good place to start. So growing up, I had a pretty tough time. My childhood was absolutely fraught with every type of abuse that exists from as early as I can remember. And so I tell you that not because that made me an alcoholic, but because I thought it did for a very long time. My dad is a child molester. He's in prison for life. My mom is a narcissist. She should be in prison for life. She's doing fine though. So that was like my growing up. That was like my core was, awful. It was awful. And so I felt like I needed to get out. I needed to get away. I needed to feel different, from the earliest that I can remember. And, you know, the first place that I found to do that was I really excelled at school. I really excelled academically. The kids there were absolutely horrible. We also grew up in a, in a religious environment, a very, very religious environment. And so, my culture around me was different than the kids around me. And so I didn't fit in. We were extremely, extremely, poverty stricken. And I wasn't taught hygiene. So I was the dirty, smelly kid who was like really weird, you know? And so kids were not nice to me. So I wasn't having a good time at home. I wasn't having a good time at recess. But the spelling bee, I could fuck you up in a spelling bee, you know? And so, that's where I excelled. That's where I, pointed toward. And so that became my first outlet was academically. It just came naturally to me. It came easy to me. I didn't ever learn how to study. I could just take a test. I knew how to read a test well, and I knew how to answer. I knew how to figure out what they were asking and how to respond. And it made me feel superior. It was a way to feel superior to all of these people who were terrible to me, including my mom, because she's basically illiterate, you know? And so, like, by six or seven years old, like, I could outread her. I could do math better than she could, which, I'll get real, was never actually that good. It put me above. It put me above in when I needed that so desperately, because I felt so, so, so small. I felt so below. I felt so lower. I felt so lesser than, that it became really important to me to feel above somebody, to feel better than. I've never not been on this, like, this ladder, these rungs of measuring myself against other people, you know? I've never understood how to be a worker among workers. I've never understood how to be one among many. I'm always above or below, and I don't like being below, so I try to get above. And so that's what I did, for a while. And then, when I was, 12, I guess, I discovered, music. Music became my new outlet, my new way to get away, my new thing that, like, took me away from here. And I quickly discovered, Marilyn Manson, since it was, you know, 1997. and because that was a long time ago now, I'll explain it to you. He was really scary. the news of like, watch out, don't let them near your kids. He was this dude who wore makeup and he was a rock star and it was crazy. And that was like my thing. That was my go-to. I was a goth kid before I ever knew what that was. My mom was pulling me Lydia from Beetlejuice since I was like six. And so, I discovered this band that I could follow that gave me that sense of belonging. And that was what I needed. That was what I was looking for. His message was, don't listen to what people are telling you. Find out for yourself. What do you think? What do you believe? Do you believe in your church? And I said, oh, shit. No, I don't. Crazy. And he said, like, you know, do you think that you're lesser than? And I was like, well, I don't know. I don't really think so. Like, that's crazy. You know, he was the one who was asking me these questions via, you know, TV interviews. But that was the message that I was receiving. And so I latched onto it. And so I started doodling. I shaved off my eyebrows and doodled all over my face. And, you know, Hot Topic was actually, like, really scary to go into back then. And that became my new persona. I put on this persona. I put on, like, this armor. I put on this gear where I got to be bigger and scarier than any of you. And what I discovered was that the world backed off when they were afraid of me. Like, I was the biggest weenie in the whole world. Like, I've never been in a fight. Like, I was not, like, violent. I was not doing any spells. Like, that's not, like, real. But I found that when people thought that I would, that was all it took. I didn't have to actually do any of those things. I just had to make people think that I would. And they backed off. And they stopped throwing ice at my head. And they stopped calling me the horrible things they were calling me. And they stopped, you know, saying things that they were saying to me. And so that was what I took on. And that became my thing. In order to enhance that, I needed a reputation to, like, go along with it. And so since I'm not getting into fights and I'm not, like, doing any of that stuff, I did smoke lots of cigarettes very visibly. And I met a girl, and her name was Laura, and she smoked and drank and went to school when she felt like and didn't when she didn't. And she stole things, and to me, she looked free. It looked like freedom. No one could tell her no. No one could tell her to do or not to do anything. She did exactly what she wanted to in this world, and she was free. And so she became my new guru. She became my new model. And I did everything that I could to learn from her. And so she was my first sponsor. And she taught me how to play haymaster, and she taught me how to panhandle, and she taught me how to sing in the shower. She taught me how to shower, actually. She taught me how to take care of my body. She was like my everything. And we were absolutely inseparable for many, many years. Ended up her addiction took her into places that I was not able to go. I won't say that I, didn't want to, because it wasn't a virtue of mine. It was just her addiction took her into places that I wasn't able to go. And she ended up losing her fight. Anyway, so she taught me how to play Hey Mister. She taught me how to drink. First time I drank, we went to downtown Bakersfield, found the dirty, smelly punk rock kids, fit in perfectly. And in our scene, it was whoever drinks the fastest gets the most. And so that's what we did. My very first time drinking, we went up to the top of this parking garage, and we had been panhandling all day, and we had probably like 6 or 7 32s between like probably 10 of us, and I felt rich. I was 13, and I had never drank before, so that seemed like a lot of booze to me. And so I drank about half of a 32 of King Cobra, and I was a one-drink wooer, I discovered. One drink, and woo! I was having a blast. I poured the second half of the beer over my own head. It seemed like a party thing to do. And some dude who was really tall had to carry me home. Like, that was my experience drinking. Like, from the get-go, it was as balls to the wall as you can go. I very quickly started blacking out, and I discovered that I fucking love a blackout. I love a blackout. I love a blackout. If I could stay in a blackout forever, I never would have gotten sober. A blackout is everything I've ever wanted. It's where I get to not exist. I get to not exist for 5 hours. It's very unfortunate that sometimes my body does not go to bed with me, and sometimes I do, like, really stupid things. But I don't know who was pissing on your couch. I don't know who slept with your boyfriend. And I don't know who stole your shit because I was asleep. I was asleep. I went to bed. And I love that. I loved that. I loved being in a blackout. And when people would wake, when I would wake up, people would tell me, they would tell me about the things, you know, and I was so, so deeply ashamed that the only defense that I had was just to play it off. Just to completely play it off. Yeah, I did it. Whatever. I'll do it again. Who cares? Like, I don't. Not me. I'm hardcore. I'm super tough. But the truth was that, like, the way that that felt in my gut, I couldn't deal. I could not deal. And the only way that I found to make that go away was to immediately get drunk again. And so by the time I was 16, I was a daily drinker. I was a daily bedwetter. Because you can't drink 80 ounces of Steel Reserve and not piss. So that's what I did. And it was pretty ugly. I got kicked out of school when I was 13. They told me you can either change the way you look or we can put, or you can not go here. And I said, well, I just don't go here anymore then. They kicked me out of one high school for tardies. I thought that was really stupid. I was like, I was late to third period. You're kicking me out of school. Like, that's crazy. And so, you know, these rules that I thought were just completely unjustified, I just refused to follow them. And then when, you know, that has consequences, I just think that the consequences are unjustified because the rules are stupid. And I'm the smartest man alive. And I didn't authorize that. I didn't authorize it. So it's stupid. I'm not participating and I'm leaving. And that became, like, my way of life was, that's stupid, and I'm not participating, and I'm leaving. And it was either that I genuinely did think it was stupid, or it was that I was really ashamed that I knew I had to go before, like, you told me to get out. When I was 14, my dad molested me again, and I was put into the foster care system. And that, again, it's stupid, and I refuse, and I'm not participating. And so I left, and I was homeless. I was on the streets of Bakersfield. I couch surfed for a while. I slept on top of buildings sometimes. You know, I did what I needed to do to stay alive and to stay drunk. Eventually, my grandma let me move in with her, and I destroyed her couch. Every day I would wake up and I would say, I am not stealing $4 out of her purse. I'm not doing it tonight. Not going to. Then every night I would steal $4 out of her purse and I would go to 7-Eleven and I would get 2 Steel Reserves. And I would come home and I would swear, okay, this time, but not tomorrow. Tomorrow I won't do this anymore. After this one, that's it. And I decided that every day. Every day I decided, tomorrow, that's it. And every day I would change my mind. Eventually she asked me to leave, because that was unsustainable. There was literally one rule in her house, like literally one. And that was, don't be drunk at home. And I just couldn't abide by that. And so I had to leave. Eventually I was out on the streets again, and eventually my aunt let me move in with her. And again, the literal exact same thing, one rule. Don't be drunk at my home with my kids. And I could not abide by that. And so she, too, asked me to leave. Luckily, though, the weekend that she asked me to leave was the weekend that I found what would be my first higher power. My first husband. I met him that weekend, and he was being kicked out of his apartment, and I was being kicked out of my aunt's house. And he didn't have any friends, and he didn't know how to be homeless, so I needed to go teach him, right? So in all of my altruism, I was going to go help him be homeless, and we'd do that together. And literally that never changed our entire marriage. That relationship, you know, he was 6'5", he didn't have eyebrows, and he had 20-eye boots up to his knees, and I don't know what else you need for a successful marriage, so I married him. He said that he knew that I was the one because the night that we met, I stole us a bottle of Jack Daniels and got into a fight with my best friend who was trying to bang him, and I wouldn't let her. So, you know, that was what we drew us together. Those were our shining qualities. And that didn't really change. We were very, very toxic together. We were very, very drunk. We were very, very, very demanding. We were very broken, sick, sick people. And that became violent pretty quickly. It escalated to physical violence within probably 2 months of us being together. I thought that I could fix him, and I thought that if I proved to him that I loved him, then he could get well, and then he could fix me, and then we could, like, be fine. Or, barring that, we could just, like, leave and go to a cave where, like, literally no one else existed except, like, maybe, like, a beer delivery service, and, like, then we could be okay, you know? But it was just ugly. It was just ugly all the time. But I was so enamored with him. I was so completely, I was just in so much pain all of the time. Every waking moment that I wasn't in a blackout was just panic and scrambling to just not feel the way that I feel all of the time. The blackout was the only place that ever made sense. And so, you know, I was always too chicken to kill myself. And so there was one time. So I only remember one moment of joy my entire life before getting sober, like real actual joy. Like there was like happiness and like excitement and like fun, but like joy. The only time I remember experiencing joy before I got sober, was we had been arguing all night. We had been fighting all night, and he was strangling me. And I was fighting back, because that's what you do when you're being strangled. and then the black started coming around my vision, around the outside of my vision. And it occurred to me, the thought occurred to me, he's going to kill me. And I was so happy. I've never been so joyful in my life. I wanted that moment to last forever and ever and ever, and I also wanted it to really hurry up. I finally get to know what it's like to die. I finally get to get out of here. Like, I stopped fighting, I laid my arms down, and it was the most present I've ever been. I had never been so present in a moment in my entire life. And I was there for all of it, and I was so ecstatic. And the black just came in, it closed in. And then I woke up, and I was very confused. I didn't remember how it had happened. It just felt like waking up from other blackouts. It just felt like that same, like, confused thing, like, oh, where am I? Okay, where's he? Okay. And he wasn't in bed, and so that made me furious. And so I went to go find him, and he was out on the payphone in front of our house screaming, I just killed my wife, I just killed my wife. I said, I'm right here, you idiot. And the cops came, and I guess because I didn't remember it, and probably because I would have lied anyway, they took him to 3B. He was schizophrenic, so they took him to 3B instead of, that's the psych ward, instead of jail. And he went in for a 5150. And it wasn't until, like, the second or third day that, like, I put it all together and I realized what had happened. I was like, oh, that got pretty intense, huh? But, I mean, it was just business as normal, you know? I mean, it didn't change anything. Like, nothing changed. That was that was a little extreme, that one. Like, maybe let's try not doing that again. But, I mean, it wasn't all that wild. It wasn't all that out of the ordinary. It wasn't all that crazy. And so, you know, nothing changed. Didn't get any different. Eventually, what happened was he broke my nose. And it was his third domestic violence. It was a broken bone, and I couldn't deny that one. And so it was a felony. He had to go away. And so he went away. I was supposed to, and I had been living on his SSI this whole time. Like, we were living in hotels on his SSI check. And I don't know how to work. I dropped out of school when I was 14. I don't know how to support myself in any way whatsoever except panhandling. And so, you know, there I am again on the streets, like out of my ass. Except now I'm like, well, I'm too old to like be doing this, you know? I mean, I was only 20, but it seemed really old. I found this program called Job Corps. If you're not familiar, it's a government run program where if you're under the age of 24 and you are below an income status, they provide training. You live there, you work there, they provide job training, they provide education. They serve it up on a platter for you to become successful. And there is literally like one rule, and it's don't drink on campus. And so I went and I was like, this is it. I'm starting over. I'm not going to be around any of my dirty, smelly punk rock friends. I can't even drink there. It's not even allowed. Guess what? I'm sober now. And so I went on Monday, and on Wednesday, my roommate had a bottle of Southern Comfort. What the fuck? Like, 2 days. 2 days. I made it. 2 days. I knew big sobriety kick. And I went to school the next day, and the kid next to me said I smelled like booze. And I said, wait, don't. And he said, okay. Very shortly, I was getting caught for drinking on the center, and they were kicking me out. And yet again, I can't. Again, I am losing. Again, I am failing. Again, I'm out of my ass. I'm homeless again because I can't follow this one rule, like one thing. I can't do it. And I had thought, you know, all the way up. I could, if I really, really wanted to, if I really tried, I could, like, chill out. But I don't really, really want to is the thing. Not all the way deep down, I don't. And so it finally came. It finally hit me. The time that I really, really did want to, all the way deep down. And I really, really tried. And I failed again. Again. And I could not believe it. I could not believe it. I couldn't understand it. I couldn't wrap my head around my own head. Like I couldn't fathom what was happening in my brain that I was here yet again. And so, I went back to my grandma's house and she told me I could stay through the weekend and that was it. I would have to figure something out. And so, I remember really sinking in, like, I can't do anything because I can't stop drinking. I can't do anything. I can't even do this school where, like, it is handed to you. Like, literally handed to you. And I can't even do that. And so, you know, TMZ and movies tell me that the only way to get sober is to go to rehab. Like, that's the only way that I knew of. And so I called around to all the rehabs in town. And the cheapest one that I found was $800 a month. And, like I told you before, like, I'm a panhandler, you know. I can come up with like maybe eight, but 800, like that's, the answer is no, it might as well be 8 million. And so, that was when I think, I had the moment that the book calls the jumping off place where, I can't imagine life with alcohol and I can't imagine life without it. And I knew loneliness such as few do. And I knew true hopelessness in that moment because the answer was no, like, I don't get to get sober. I don't get to. Like, that's not for me. I am going to die this way. And that was my experience. That was all I had seen was that people like me, we die this way. That's it. And that's all. And so it was almost insulting that I had thought for a second to even call around to those rehabs because, of course, I do not get to do that. And so, so I had to get real about how I was gonna get on out of here. And so I was planning on how I was going to, and I was gonna kill myself so that it would least impact my grandma, who was the only person on the face of this planet who does not deserve to be hurt and is the person that I continuously, harm in numerous ways. And she is the most beautiful angel on the face of this planet and absolutely did not deserve any of the havoc that I brought upon her. And so I needed to mitigate that as best I could. And so I was planning out, how and, I had planned out how And now I was planning out where. And the phone rang, and it was my school. It was Job Corps. And they said if I was willing to go to rehab, they were willing to send me. And I said, okay, that's bonkers. Like, that is crazy, because I'm literally sobbing here right now, planning my actual suicide, like, right this actual minute. That's crazy. Yes, I would love to go to rehab. And so they said, come back to the center, and we'll get you in. And so that's what I did. I went back to San Bernardino, and they got me into a treatment center. It was a 60-day treatment center, and I graduated there with 59 days sober. Because I could not imagine going into a rehab without alcohol in pill form. And so I absolutely brought that with me, and I absolutely did that the first night. And then the next day, I was mostly afraid of getting caught with the illicit substances in the rehab. I was mostly afraid of getting caught and getting kicked out. But also, there was a part of me that really, really did want this. And so if I'm really going to do this, then I have to really give it a real shot. And so that's what I decided to do. So I'm flushing them, I'm getting rid of them all, and I'm just going to keep two, like, just for in cases, you know. 60 days is a really long time, and things might go wild. I might need these. And a voice happened inside my head that was not mine, and I know, like, that one. And it wasn't the normal one. And it said, how are you going to get this if you're saving drugs for later? And I said, good point. Bet. And so I think it was probably my first act of real courage that came from not inside me, but it was my first real act of courage that I flushed them. And I said, okay, I'm doing this. And it was in that moment that I turned my will and my life over to that 60-day program right then. And I said, all right, you guys got 59 days to fix me. And when this doesn't work, I have my plan set out. But I'm going to try. That way my grandma knows I tried everything. My grandma knows I did everything, even stupid rehab. So I threw myself in, and they said I needed to get a higher power. And I said, whoa, see. But the thing about that is that I grew up in a religious cult. So me and God, not pals. And they said, well, figure that out. And so I got that book, Came to Believe. And I was like, all right, there must be some instructions in here on how to learn how to believe in Santa Claus. Let's do it. And I searched that book for it. I searched it. And I found one line that worked. One line that said, pray with sincerity, if not yet believe. I said, okay, because I can sincerely say that I cannot do this. I can sincerely say that I need help. I can sincerely say that I lose. I lost. But I don't have any belief, and it said I didn't have to. So I was like, great, because I don't. And so that's what I did, though. That anxiety, that pit, oh, God, it was the worst. Aside from the nightmare, the pit in my stomach was a nightmare. Couldn't sleep, sweat, it was just awful. It was awful. And so I would just lay in that bed, like, all night, just praying to nothing and saying that. Praying to nothing. And eventually what happened was I had an experience that was undeniable to me that it just wasn't the logical conclusion for me anymore, that there was nothing out there, that there was nothing for me. And I got to have a spiritual experience. The book talks about it being rocketed in the fourth dimension. I got to experience that. And that was the beginning of my journey into this program. I graduated out of that program, and I went to a couple AA meetings, and it was just a couple, like, where I was in the meeting that I went to, it was, like, four people who were talking about meth. And listen, I smoked a lot of meth, but that was not my problem, and so I didn't feel like I fit. I didn't feel like that was my spot. I didn't get anything out of it, and so I said, it's all right. It's cool. I'm cured. I'm fixed. And so, so I went on about my merry way. I said, hey, I don't need AA. I thought this was just like the aftercare, the follow-up, you know? And I was like, oh, I'm good. I'm fixed. I did my treatment. And so so I went on about my life. What I did do, though, was I did everything in my power to enlarge my spiritual life. I had had this experience, a spiritual experience that was transformative, and I had met a person who was so amazing, so unbelievably divine, that if she existed, God had to. and she became my first real sponsor. She didn't know that's what she was, and she's not in the program, but she was my first spiritual advisor, and that's what I have always called her, was my first spiritual advisor. And so I grew my spiritual life, and I firmly believe that that is what came between me and a drink for the next year. When I got back to Bakersfield, my husband had gotten out of prison, and it took me a little while to find him, but when I did, he thought I was his new girlfriend calling, and so I flipped out and I lost it, you know? And I asked my friends for a chemical solution, and it was only in their grace and God's grace that that I didn't have to go out right then. Magic happened again. Magic stepped in, and you know, this is how I know that my higher power doesn't need my permission to work in my life, because like literally had no permission whatsoever and was like calling me up on the phone while I'm sobbing, planning my suicide, you know, literally stepping in when my junkie friends are like, "Nah, man, you're sober." Like, you know, it's crazy. It's just crazy. I can't believe in coincidences anymore. So anyway, I stay with him though, of course, and he's relapsing like 5 to 7 times a week. I would just call it drinking. He called it relapsing. But so I start dragging him to meetings because you, sir, you need to go to aftercare. I'm cured. I'm fixed. All better. But you need some help. And so I started dragging him to meetings. And it was me that came out of there that was like, "Oh my God, did you hear what they said? Like, we should get sponsors. Like, we should like get a book. Like, that'd be crazy, right?" And he had really no interest. And eventually what happened was, he didn't feel the need to stay, and I did. And I went to his house, and I found him with 2 beers, face full of makeup, because he's a goth kid, and waiting on a girl to pick him up. And something happened inside me. God did for me again what I can't do for myself. And I started getting my things. And he said, "You don't have to go." And I said, "No, but this time I want to." And what had happened was it clicked inside my head. Like, I cannot stay sober and stay with him. Am I willing to die for him? And all the way up until that point, the answer was yes. Like, yes, please, actually. Preferably. And suddenly the answer was no. I'm not willing to die for him. And so I got my things, and I left, and I joined AA is what happened. I did get a sponsor, and started working the steps. And I had never been single my entire life. And I was single, and I was employed. I was employable. That's bonkers. I was employed. I learned how to drive. I got a driver's license. I got a job. I got an apartment. I had my cute little studio apartment. I turned into a cute little pink princess bedroom because I'd never had one. And it was just the time of my life. And I threw myself into this program, and the world opened up. I became a person that, like, literally, like, I had no concept of. I couldn't have ever fathomed. I've gone through things in this program that I never would have expected that I could ever get through, you know? The joy that I experience in my life today is bonkers. It's bonkers. Like, it's like flipped. Like, it's like moments of not being joy. It's moments, and it's, well, sometimes days, of like not feeling good about my life rather than the opposite, you know? So when I was 4 years sober, I was dating a dude, and we were very active in YPAW and young people in AA, and he too fell ill and needed to get on out of here. And so I believe that his options were get well, get drunk, or get dead. And he picked get dead. And that was something that I never could have fathomed walking through and staying sober. But I did it with you. I did it by staying connected. I did it by staying in meetings. I did it by going to work. I did it by going to my sponsors. I did it by my best friend picking me up and saying, "Get in the car," and taking me to the Hearst Castle in my literal pajamas and slippers. because it was 2 hours away and that could keep me out of my house for 4 hours, you know? It was my best friend saying, turn off, Mad World. Stop listening to that song on repeat and, let's go to a meeting. That's how I walked through that. 4 years later, my grandma had to leave. My grandma had to go home. My grandma had to, get on out of here. And, that was my biggest reservation when I got sober. I couldn't have imagined any of the other stuff, but I mean, you can imagine your grandma dying, right? And so I knew that was like the one, like if anything, I can't promise what's going to happen if my grandma goes. And, my grandma died and it was awful and it was horrible and it still is. And I was able to walk through it pretty gracefully, sober for sure. And I did it with you. I did it in these rooms. I did it with my sponsor. I did it with my friends showing up to my house and saying, get in the car. I met a man who, he was 5'5" and a bodybuilder and five years younger than me. And like, none of those are like my jam. And I spent about a month, telling my roommate how I did not have a crush on a short guy before I realized that if you don't have a crush on a short guy, you don't have to tell anyone that you don't have a crush on a short guy. And shit, I have a crush on a short guy. And it turns out he's the most incredible human I've ever met in my entire life. We have been together for 11 years. We just celebrated 7 years of marriage. Not only is our marriage not violent, it's not even toxic. It's not even, you know, even in our worst fights, we're not unkind. Even in our worst fights, neither of us is trying to hurt the other. And I couldn't fathom being that kind of person in a relationship, much less like finding someone else to be that. When I did my ideals list in my fourth step, my sponsor, I brought it to her, this list for this perfect person, right? And she said, great, now go become that. And I did my absolute best to become that. And that meant that I have to be a person who doesn't seek to do harm. That means that I have to be a person who is considerate and is thoughtful and does put someone else above myself. That means that I have to do my absolute best to getting and staying well, to be the best partner that I can be. And it was cool. It worked. I set out to be that, and I found that. It's kind of cool. We have two beautiful fur children, which is all that I want. Well, I would love to have more cats, but my son won't let me. He is an only child. But we have a really, really good life. I'm back in school today. That's crazy because I dropped out when I was 14. I'm halfway through my bachelor's degree. I'm getting a degree in biology. I'm currently, I know, right? I'm looking at scientists. Like, that's crazy. It's crazy. Nature, it's bonkers. Have you seen leaves? Plants are my new thing right now. Plants are my thing. It's my kitchen. No, it's wild. It's wild to life. I don't care about a plant. I don't ever care about a plant. The only plant I ever cared about was a hop, you know? Like, that's it. Like, a barley, maybe? An oak barrel. I've never cared about nature. I've never cared about a plant. I've never cared about anything. But today I'm interning in a laboratory. I'm like doing science. Like I was like running DNA samples today. That's crazy. That's crazy to me, you know? And it's because I've worked the steps. It's because I apply this program in my life. It's because I keep showing up and it's because I stay connected. Even through the pandemic, I went online. I'm still online. I love online. I get to connect with people that, like, I'm not limited by location anymore, by being online. It's amazing the way the world has opened up. My sponsor is in Manteca, so she's, like, 4 hours away from me, and we're incredibly close, and we're in meetings all the time. My life is amazing. My life has opened up in ways that I just never could have imagined because I have applied this program in my life, and so... you know, it's been a journey and it hasn't been easy, but it has always been worth it. So if you haven't found here what I have found here, I definitely, definitely urge you to not keep coming back, but to stay. and don't leave before the miracle happens, because it happens, you know. I was firmly planted in the idea that this is not for me. I do not get to get this. And I had lots of evidence to support that idea. And it turns out that this is for any of us. It's for all of us. The only requirement is the desire to stop drinking. This program has never, ever, ever required me that I'm perfect. It's never even to my own moral compass. It's never demanded that I live up to my own moral compass. It has only demanded that I do my best. And I think that is where the miracle happens. I think the miracle is in me always striving to do the best that I can. And I'll get real. Sometimes my best sucks. Sometimes my best sucks. But I am doing my best at all times. And I think there's a magic in that. And I've definitely found magic here. My life is full of magic these days. And I hope that you are also experiencing magic. And if not, stick around, because it's here. That's it for me. Thanks.